houses on its oil submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are Southwestern Bell Telephone Company versus Garza from Cameron County in the 13th Appellate District. Carl Joseph Taglia and Tommy A. Polk versus Lisa Jones Alexander and others from Harris County and the 14th Appellate Judicial District. And Compaq Computing Corporation versus Hal LaPrey from Jefferson County and the 9th Appellate Judicial District. In each of these matters, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We will complete these arguments before lunch, but we will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument. And if you wish to purchase a tape of any argument, you may do so by making application with the clerk of our court. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Southwestern Bell versus Garza.
Mike Hatchell will present an argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, this is a retaliatory discharge case under Section 451.001 of the Labor Code. Based on a finding that the plaintiff was disqualified from his position or discharged from his position for filing a workers' compensation claim, the jury awarded $1 million in actual damages and $1 million in punitive damages. The three issues that we have raised on appeal are, is there evidence of a statutory violation? Is there evidence of malice to support the punitive damage award? And was the case properly submitted in terms of the statute? I think we will only be able to argue two of those, and I prefer to argue the first two issues, although I'm prepared to address all of them this morning. Regarding the liability question, the legal test which was given the jury is that jury was told that an employer does not violate the statute if the employer would have disqualified the employee when it did. In other words, if Garza had not filed the comp claim. In other words, but for the comp claim, Mr. Garza would not have been discharged or disqualified. I realize that the parties have treated the court to a blizzard of facts in this case, but analytically, I think this case falls very comfortably under the absence of control cases. And the no evidence argument can be dispatched really very summarily. In the absence of control cases, what you have is a situation where it is unquestioned that an employee has been disciplined or discharged because of a violation of a standing policy. And in that case, the Chief Justice made a fairly strong statement by simply saying that it cannot be the case that termination would not have occurred when it did, but for the employee's assertion of a compensation claim. In other words, it's virtually impossible for a retaliatory discharge to have occurred in a situation where the discharge is based on absence of control. What we have in this case is almost identical because we have an employee who, beginning in 1987, was threatened with termination if he had another accident regardless of fault. And then in 1989 and in 1992, he was also either given or threatened with the precise employment action that was taken in this case, which was disqualification from his outside plant technician's job. In other words, outside having to work either with V-Lives. When in 1994 he had the accident that is made the basis of this suit, the precise same discipline was administered as had been threatened as early as 1987. The accident occurred on a Thursday, October the 20th, and the evidence which has been cited by the plaintiffs, by the Court of Appeals, and by us, is that on that Thursday or the following Friday, the supervisors of the employee in question made the decision to essentially invoke the threats that had been made in prior years.
Was there any written memorial of that decision?
There is
contemporaneous with it.
There is not a written memorial of that decision, Your Honor. The first written memorial that you have of that decision is found in can't remember the exact exhibit number. I believe it's PX10 or PX11, which is the report of the supervisor. It's actually dated November the 7th, but the interesting thing about that report is it contains statements to the effect that there had been no injury involved in the case, and all of the testimony from all of the supervisors is that the decision which shows up in that memorandum had been made on the Thursday or Friday following the accident, and the comp claim was not asserted until the following Monday. So basically our position is that the wheels were in motion before the employee in this case had knowledge of the compensation claim, and using the Chief Justice's approach in the absence of control cases, we say that it was essentially inexorable that this employment decision was going to be made regardless of knowledge of the compensation claim.
Mr. Hatchell, you referred to your client's driving policy. Is it undisputed that Mr. Garza did not have three unsafe acts while operating a motor vehicle within 24 months? And that's obviously one of the points of contention that's been made, that that policy was not violated, although that was part of the discipline that Mr. Garza had taken off his driving abilities at Southwesternville.
The answer to your question is that it is undisputed that he was not in violation of the driving policy at the time. But I think it is also undisputed that he was not disqualified because of a violation of the driving policy. He was not disqualified from driving. In effect, he was, but he was disqualified from the position of outside plant technician, which peripherally included driving. And I think that opposing counsel has done a good job to try to make this appear to be a violation of policy, but unfortunately it fails because that policy is simply inapplicable in these particular circumstances. That policy states on its face that the employer reserves to itself all rights to discipline regardless of violation of the policy. So number one, it was inapplicable in this case, and number two, it could not be an ultimate litmus test.
Since your time is so limited, let me go to the second point that you want to make. Has this court ever established the evidentiary standard under which we review a punitive damages award?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And I have read much of the case law regarding the clear and convincing standard has been written after the briefing closed in this case. But I think, as the court knows as well as I do, that those very excellently crafted opinions ultimately has come to the conclusion that the statement of the law is that what we are looking for in a no evidence of malice context is some evidence from which the jury could reach a firm conviction of malice in this case. The Chief Justice may remember in 1937, W. St. John Garwood wrote an article on a review of factual sufficiency of the evidence, and he came as close as I think as I've ever seen to articulating how a court looks at evidence. I would answer your question, Your Honor, and this is me speaking, because I have thought through this issue, that what the court should consider is among the things the court should consider are the following. To what degree is the ultimate fact, in this case malice, dependent on or refuted by inferences from evidence? To what degree are there other reasonable inferences from the same evidence? To what degree is the inference drawn from or rebutted by the sheer absence of evidence rather than positive facts? Where intent is the issue, as it is in this case, to what degree is it necessary to interpret intent from other facts? How reasonable is that interpretation? To what degree is the ultimate fact dependent on scientifically irrefutable or unrebuttable evidence like documents? And then finally, and I think to this extent I may disagree with some of the writings of the court, I actually believe that if there is a factual dispute underlying the underlying the ultimate fact, in a clear and convincing review, How evenly divided that dispute is and how seriously credibility is impugned may actually be a factor for the court considered. And I realize that the court has held, and I think legitimately in many respects based on prior precedent, but Judge Garwood in his 1937 article says that the court must come perilously close to looking at credibility issues in that determination as well.
Heretofore, we have established a clear and convincing evidentiary review only when mandated by the United States Constitution or our Constitution.
That's correct.
And the Supreme Court has declined to mandate that, at least under the United States Constitution, right, in its review of punitive damages. So this, on the other hand, most of the time, we do have a clear and convincing standard for the gross negligence.
Correct.
And so this kind of falls into a gray area, because most of the time when we set up that standard, it's because it's constitutionally mandated.
Well, of course, we may have an Osterberg versus Pekka issue here, because clear and convincing standard was given the jury, and nobody has complained about that in this case. So I understand Your Honor's concerns in that regard, but I have briefed this case as if that is the controlling standard, because it is the standard to which the jury was specifically charged and to which neither party made an objection. And so I have tried in our briefing as best we can to hook on to the court's most recent writings in the parental termination cases, to which I find very, very well done opinions, which we find some solace, but not the kind of analytical construct by which we measure the clash of evidence to determine what the clear and convincing standard is. In this particular...
Does the Campbell case, do you think, from the U.S. Supreme Court, require that we look at the evidence differently than we would in another case?
I don't think that if it is not constitutionally mandated, no, I do not think so. I do think that in any case, and I think the court is fairly clear on this, where the clear and convincing standard applies, that clearly we're looking at some intermediate level of review that falls between preponderance and beyond a reasonable doubt. And in this case, as I say, the parties have assumed that burden, and I'm assuming that it overlays on this particular case. But
there are two situations. There's the case, as in the free speech context,
yes,
where not only do you have a heightened burden to show actual malice, for example, but the appellate court is constitutionally obliged to look at the evidence anew. And then you may have another situation where you have a higher burden, but the court is not under that obligation.
Yes, I think that's true, and I think the issue there, which is, I think, an extremely sophisticated issue, is focused upon how much deference is given to the trial courts, if the trial court is the trier of fact or the jury, how much deference is given to the ability to resolve factual disputes and determine credibility issues. I personally think that the notion of de novo review in a no evidence context is somewhat of a non sequitur, because I always view no evidence as, to a large measure, being a question of de novo review. In other words, determining the legal effect of facts that are essentially undisputed, or those that we would assume the jury accepted. So I find myself being somewhat confused by the overlay of de novo. It doesn't help me in my analytical construct to any great extent, but in this particular case, I do not. This is obviously not a constitutionally mandated de novo review, but I think I have suggested that in any, and it would really be nice if we could have one standard for clear and convincing review. Although I understand, particularly emanating from Pitney versus Bunton, that there may be even a more heightened standard of review in the First Amendment cases. But I hope that I have been of some help in giving the court what I think are the way in which you analyze the clashes of evidence. But in this particular case,
Mitchell, still related to that standard on appeal, as you recognize, where parental rights are involved, the First Amendment's involved, we have mandated, following substantially the U.S. Supreme Court, a review that seeks to find a firm belief or conviction that the trial court's findings were true. This case doesn't involve those same kinds of constitutional issues. The only case you cite for the appellate standard is Turner versus KTRK, which involves First Amendment, constitutional issues, and you cite the higher standard of appellate review in this clear and convincing evidence context. Explain your justification for doing that, if it's more than just having your belief that we should have one standard of appellate review for clear and convincing evidence.
Well, my justification for citing, pardon me, I didn't mean to cut you off. My justification for citing that is because Osterberg versus Pekka requires that I assume clear and convincing is the standard in this case, I have to look somewhere for a definition of clear and convincing evidence. And I've not seen a definition of clear and convincing that drops below the firm conviction requirement. So that's why I cited those cases. What I think happens when you have the constitutionally mandated issues is there is some tweaking, as I have indicated to Mr. Justice Heck, of the deference which is given to the resolution of underlying factual disputes and credibility issues, which I suggest in a case of this nature should be considered.
But we, because of our, well, have you cited Judge Garwood's review?
I have not, as a matter of fact.
Because of the constitutional limitations on our factual review, we have to be very careful in this area apart from a federal mandate.
Yes, there's no question about that. That's the only discussion, though, where I have ever seen where the former justice of this court actually analyzes the way the court thinks about the clash of evidence in deciding issues as factual sufficiency and, in this case, clear and convincing and no evidence. I mean, to me, it is very, very important to be able to do that. If I could give you an example, if you have a testimonial statement versus a document, that's a clash, and the document wins because it's irrefutable. That's what I find has been lacking in the articulation of the clear and convincing standard to this point. And it's not this court's fault. It's just that it has not had the opportunity to write on that yet. This overlay of clear and convincing now coming to us through statutes rather than the Constitution is new to this court, and I think we're all plowing new ground.
Any other questions?
Just one. Mr. Hatchell, do you see a difference between a standard of review and a burden of proof, and the interrelation of those two principles?
The standard of review, I think, is always driven by the burden of proof. So, yes, I see certainly there clearly has to be a difference between the standard of review and the burden of proof to the extent to which you are permitting the fact finder free rein to resolve disputes or resolve credibility questions. So they're not coincidental, except perhaps in the instance in which Mr. Justice Heck was talking about.
Do you see the burden of proof being a factual inquiry rather than a legal inquiry?
Well, a burden of proof, to me, is always the overlay of law on the facts. It sets the minimum standard to which a party saddled with the burden of proof must rise. And so it's a legal overlay, I think, on the facts.
Thank you.
Wouldn't you agree that it's more problematic, too, when you're dealing with an issue like pretext that is only going to be established primarily with circumstantial evidence?
Absolutely, Your Honor, and that's why I said in the first element that I talked about, to what degree is the ultimate fact dependent or refuted by inferences from evidence? And I agree with you entirely. I think it's...
Doesn't that further limit our review as opposed to expand it?
Well, I think that... harking back to Mr. Justice Jefferson's recent opinion in the King Ranch case, in which he talks about the sheer absence of evidence being no evidence, that I think you can look at factors like that to determine whether the standard of review has been met or not met. And so I don't see it as limiting this court's ability to review, but I do see it is raising a very sophisticated, complicated issue for the court, and I'm glad I don't have to resolve.
Thank you, counsel. court is ready to hear argument on this matter.
May it please the court, Ms. Catherine Driscoll-Julia will present argument before the respondent.
May it please the court. For Southwestern Bell to prevail today, this court would have to ignore settled law on preservation of error and waiver requirements on several fronts. You would also have to create a new standard for preservation of charge error where the trial court says, all right, counsel, do y'all have any objection to the question I'm going to submit to the jury? And counsel says, no, Your Honor, I have no objection. And yet the trial court is supposed to say, you know what, counsel, I don't believe you, because that's what happened in this case. They would be rewriting the standard for charge preservation. And you would also have to rewrite the standard of review for sufficiency, whereby you're allowed to substitute your judgment on the facts and say, you know what, Southwestern Bell, I like your version better.
Well, you agree that the clear and convincing burden applies.
Yes,
not as a legal matter, but as a matter that was unobjected to in the charge.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was our burden to produce clear and convincing evidence that Southwestern Bell acted with malice in order for us to recover punitive damages in this case. But I do believe that this court has set out what the standard of review is when reviewing clear and convincing evidence in a malice situation, and I think all we need to do is look at Fort Worth versus Zimlich. And as this court has held, we're going to treat the retaliatory actions under the Labor Code the same as the retaliatory actions under the Whistleblower Act. And in Zimlich, this court said, for finding punitive damages, we turn to whether there is any evidence that Donahoe engaged in his retaliatory conduct with the intent to cause the plaintiff injury, or that he carried out his act with a flagrant disregard for their rights or actual awareness that their actions in reasonable probability could result in harm. I think that that's saying that what the standard is we're looking for a scintilla or any evidence to support
a firm conviction or belief.
Yes, to support the firm conviction or belief, definitely. Affirmation.
Well, is that different from no evidence review where you don't have to find something to support a firm conviction?
Well, I think that all I can do is look at the cases where we've applied gross negligence for punitive damages findings, and knowing that in those no evidence reviews or legal sufficiency reviews, the court has said, well, when we're looking for that scintilla to support clear and convincing evidence in punitive damages, we're going to look at the whole record, whereas the typical legal sufficiency review in the whistleblower and labor code actions, which was, of course, then affirmed again by the unanimous finding of this court in Lenz versus Lenz, is that we're only going to look at the evidence and the inferences that tend to support the finding of the jury, and we're going to disregard everything else. So I think that the standard is different in that you have to look at the entire record and all of the evidence rather than just the evidence and inferences that support the firm belief of malice. But I do still believe that we're looking for any evidence or a scintilla to support that firm belief.
But did you say,
just to put a little finer point on it, when we're doing a no evidence review, negligence, for example, all we're looking for is some evidence that somebody who's rational could have concluded negligence from. But here you think we have to look at evidence that would not only persuade a rational person, but has to give a firmer belief. It has to really, in essence, be clear and convincing.
Well, again, all I can do is look at the language that this court wrote in the Zimlich opinion, which is we turn to whether there is any evidence. And so I think if you look at the record,
to support a firm belief, that's what I'm
exactly to support a firm belief. And in this case, I think that we look to, for finding punitive damages, we look at, well, what types of cases are going to rise to the level that we're going to allow a finding of actual malice and we're going to allow punitive damages to be recovered, and we only have to look at Continental Coffee. In Continental Coffee, you said, only the most egregious violations of the statute are going to warrant a finding of actual malice and award of punitive damages. And in this case, Southwestern Bell not only violated the statute, they did it egregiously. affirmation of this case, the lower court's finding, and affirmation of what the 12 jurors found and the trial court.
Before you go there, let me a couple more questions about the standard here. I didn't see any citations to any of our opinions in your brief about the standard of review and appeal. Was Zimlich cited there?
Zimlich is cited in Southwestern Bell's brief.
Then what other cases that cite our standard of review of clear and convincing evidence appeal would you agree with? Do you agree that NRA JFC also cites the correct standard of review of clear and convincing evidence on appeal? Of course, that involves parental rights.
I think that points to, I think, what is the mistake in Mr. Hatchell's reasoning when he cites Turner, which is the First Amendment case, and trying to say that there's a heightened standard of review for clear and convincing. What they've done is instead of taking it, you know, from what have we generally done in gross negligence where we've applied to the clear and convincing standard at trial and say what's our review, they're trying to cite cases where there is a heightened burden, such as in termination of parental rights, which is this court has found to be a fundamental constitutional issue. They're citing First Amendment cases, which this court knows is a...
What's the difference? A clear and convincing evidence, whether it's legislatively mandated or constitutionally mandated, from a logical standpoint, why would the review be any different from case to case?
I don't know why it would be. I just know what I've read in the cases, and it seems to be that the heightened standard has only been applied in those cases where there was a constitutional mandate, such as First Amendment cases.
Why should there be a difference, logically? I mean, if you're weighing something, measuring something, why would you apply a different standard when clear and convincing evidence is a burden of proof? Why would that change the standard of review and appeal from case to case?
Well, other than the fact that this court has said that, you know, we have to look at, you know, apply federal law when we're talking about U.S. constitutional issues, or other than the fact when they say, when you've said that you have to apply a heightened and different standard when you're talking about fundamental issues, maybe there should be one standard. But I think in this case, regardless of the standard that you apply, whether it's a heightened standard or a no evidence scintilla standard, you're still going to find clear and convincing evidence that Southwestern Bell acted with malice.
As far as Southwestern Bell being legally responsible for these damages, you concede you have to live by the charge the jury was given on actions of a principal ratification. What are the legal standards by which the corporation can be charged with the conduct of its actors?
Yes, Justice Phillips. I of course agree that we're bound by what we put in the charge, and you know, maybe we made a mistake and we should have gone with a less onerous standard, which of course there are less onerous definitions of vice principal, but we're stuck with what was in there. But I think what's interesting about that point, and obviously it's something that Texas Association of Business is very concerned about because it was the entire subject of their amicus to this court, and saying, please, you can't, you know, hold people responsible for acts of actual malice if they didn't prove managerial agent. But that particular issue is not ripe for this court's review because it was never raised in the trial court. They never made a complaint that there was no evidence of managerial agent, nor was it raised at the 13th Court of Appeals. Never, which is why the 13th Court of Appeals opinion is silent on the issue of what evidence there was to support managerial agency, because Southwestern Bell didn't raise it at that court, and therefore it's not ripe for this court to consider. It's interesting because, you know, Mr. Hatchell devoted substantial number of pages to that issue in his brief and, you know, made very eloquent arguments. But Mr. Hatchell was not the attorney that was involved at the 13th Court of Appeals level, and that attorney wasn't involved at the trial court level. And so I think that's why we have to go back to the first issue that I said is presented before this case, this court, which is they're asking for a new law on preservation and waiver that's just... It's just incredible. And I think that we should look at, typically, what do we have in law, in cases? You have the upside-down pyramid. You go to your case, you go to your trial, and you throw in every objection you can think of. You object to the evidence, you object to the testimony, you object to the pleadings, you object to the charge. And then, if you lose, you narrow it down for your intermediate appeal, and you say, okay, what really was harmful error, or what you know, would entitle us to another shot at it, and you winnow it down and make your arguments a little bit more succinct and more direct. And then, well, if you lose at that level, then you come before this court and you narrow it down further and fine-tune those arguments so that this court can have the opportunity to really decide what's at issue in this case. And it's just as Wainwright wrote this summer in Henry BLD, you know, accuracy in judicial decision-making is very important as far as preservation of error, because that way the lower courts have had the opportunity to consider and rule, thereby giving this court the benefit of other judicial review. And in this case, the opposite is happening. They started out at the trial court with Mr. Steiger making no objections. They never objected to the pleadings. They never filed special exceptions. He never objected to the evidence that was admitted on disqualification or retaliatory disqualification or taking him off of driving. He didn't object to the charge. Not only did he not object, the court asked him, do you have any objections to question number one on liability? And his answer was no. And there is no case.
Mr. Hatchell says that's in the context of just having submitted a complete charge and have the judge say, well, we don't need to go through this issue by issue. I'm not going to give it. Here's my charge.
With all due respect to Mr. Hatchell, I think that that's a distortion of what happened. In every case, you go in and one side gives their version of the charge and the other side gives their version of the charge. Then the court says, all right, I'm going to go either with yours or I'm going to do my own. The court should be able to rely on what the attorney has said last. Mr. Steiger, in this case, never made any objection, never made the court aware. And as you said in the Payne decision in 1992, there should be but one test for determining whether or not they've preserved error in the charge, and that is, was the trial court aware of the complaint?
Well, but the problem here is, looking back, it's kind of hard to see. I mean, if a trial judge says, I'm not going to give you what you want, now do you still have any objection? It's a bold soul who says, yes, I renew all of my objections one by one again, Judge.
But actually, Justice Heck, that's not what happened in this court, because what happened in this court, the judge didn't say, I'm not going to give you what you want. All Mr. Steiger said is, I'm objecting because you didn't include my instruction on the liability question. And the court said, well, I included it in my question. Now, do you have any objection to my question? And he said, no. And look at Payne. How was the court aware that there was a complaint? Well, one side wanted it to be a premises defect, and the other side wanted it to be a special defect. That was what the case was about. That was the question of law before the court. The court was obviously aware. And also in Payne, the lawyer objected, might have made the wrong objection, but he still objected and said, you know, I think the question you're submitting is wrong. In no case.
Do you think disqualification is different from discrimination?
No, I believe that disqualification is the form of discrimination that Mr. Garza suffered in this case, and that goes to the issue of valid versus invalid theory. Again, I have to premise what I'm going to say by it. They waived it because they didn't raise the issue at trial at all, and they didn't give the trial court the opportunity to correct any error if there was. But let's look at whether or not this was a proper thing to be put in before the jury, this issue of disqualification. The statute says that you may not discharge or in any other manner discriminate against an employee for filing a comp claim. The clear language says that discharge is one of the types of discrimination that an employee can face, because obviously discharge on its own is not some evil thing. We live in an at-will state. You can fire anybody for any reason or no reason, but if you fire them in retaliation for filing a comp claim, you violated Section 451.001 of the Labor Code. As this court has said, when people have complained about broad form submission, where you know, list all the various alleged fraudulent statements that the defendant has made, this court has said there's nothing wrong with that. As a matter of fact, in Scott versus Atchison, separate questions are not required. Limitation may be accomplished very simply by including in a single issue all of the alleged negligent acts. Just like in Fort Worth versus Zimlick, the court was charged, hey, did they violate whistleblower by sending him to work security at the courthouse, or failing to give him his promotion, or failing to make him a deputy? Sending somebody to work security at the courthouse in and of itself is certainly not, you know, some evil act, but it is a violation of the Whistleblower Act, and this court found that there was sufficient evidence in that case to show that retaliatory action. same thing in this case. We could have gone down the line. We could have said, all right, did they violate 451 by discharging him, disqualifying him from driving, and making him work as the janitor? None of those are invalid theories. They are all simply stating the alleged specific retaliatory actions of Southwestern Bell under the same legal theory of 451. You know, again, Spencer versus Eagle, which is another case that Southwestern Bell has cited in their brief, again, in that case, Eagle Star objected to the charge, and the problem in that case was that the insurance code under which they were suing said that you can only maintain a cause of action under specifically enumerated subsections of this chapter. Well, the labor code doesn't hold us to that. The labor code says you can file your cause of action if they discharge or in any other manner discriminate against their employee for filing a workers' comp claim. Mr. Hatchell, in his argument today, talked a lot about the evidence of the violation and his version of why there was no evidence of the violation. And he says that the absence of control cases apply. And I believe that the case that he was talking about was the one where, you know, there was a well-settled policy of the company that if you're gone for more than 6 months, then you're going to lose your job. And in that case, plaintiff was gone for longer than 6 months, and they uniformly applied the policy that they had, and they fired him from his job. And there was no violation of the statute. In this case, we did not have adherence to well-stated policies. He says, all right, well, we should win because we just meted out the precise same discipline that was threatened back in 87 and again in 92. But that's not true. In those cases, the discipline that was threatened was that he was going to be taken off the payroll, that he was going to be fired. And each time one of those threats...
Well, then what happened was better.
Pardon?
What happened was better then?
No, because...
This was worse than being fired.
This was worse than being fired, and it goes to the malice. It was worse than being fired, as the testimony was, by disqualifying him from driving, and they didn't just disqualify him from outside work, because he said, fine, then let me go back to the engineering department where I worked before. I'll work as a frameman. That's an inside job, so I'm no longer an outside plant technician, and all I have to do is maybe drive a Ford Escort from location to location. And Southwestern Bell said, oh, no, we're not going to let you drive the Ford Escort, even though you did it for 2.5 years before without incident or accident or any safety violations, because you haven't just been disqualified from outside plant work. You've been disqualified from driving. And as 230-plus-year employees of Southwestern Bell testified, in over 700 grievance proceedings that they had been in, and in all of their years at Southwestern Bell, they had never seen an employee disqualified from driving the way David Garza was. And that goes again to disparate treatment. It goes again to one of the standards that was enumerated in Continental Coffee for how to prove causation. Also, you know, the trial court was able to hear the disparate treatment when they compared Louis Hernandez's file, that was his partner, to his file. And there were 12 violations of Louis Hernandez. They had photographs of him out there with no hard hat, without his belt on, you know, hauling trailers that he wasn't supposed to, without a hitch. They admitted that he had dropped cables with heavy hooks, metal hooks on them. That was clearly a safety violation. Told David Garza, you ought to get a lawyer, and this is, if this guy makes any issue with you, be prepared to call security. They were able to compare the disparate treatment, because what happened to his partner as a result of all of those egregious safety violations? Nothing. He didn't even have him listed as unsafe on his yearly review. The partner came out unscathed, and yet David Garza was disqualified from driving. You know,
let's assume, let me redirect you a little bit here, I may interrupt, that the managerial agent vice principal issue was preserved. Is there any evidence that the general manager, for instance, Wayne Ryder, had authority to hire as well as fire in the record?
It certainly was not proved by direct evidence, and there's no case that requires that you prove the ability to hire, fire, and engage in non-delegable duties by direct evidence. You don't have to put them on the stand and say, no, isn't it true you have the ability to hire, and isn't it true you have the ability to fire? because just like in discrimination cases generally, as this court has said and as the Seventh Circuit has said, you're rarely going to prove those by direct evidence.
And Mr. Ryder did say, if the citation from the record in the briefing is accurate, that he ultimately made the decision to terminate Mr. Garza.
Yes, Justice.
What about evidence of the other two prongs?
The evidence of the non-delegable duties and the hiring?
Correct.
Well, the fact that he said that he had the ability to hire David and give him work as an outside contractor, the fact that he said that he had in his department the 500 people working for him, the fact that...
The first point you mentioned, where you said Mr. Ryder said he had the ability to hire him as an outside contractor and give him duties, where is that in the record? Do you know offhand, or can you submit it?
I can submit it in a letter brief, and it goes to the whole issue of, hey, you know, if they really were firing him or disqualifying him from driving as a result of a safety violation, then why would they tell him that he could and should do exactly the same work for Southwestern Bell just in an independent contractor status? I see my time is out, and would simply say that the retaliation in this case was swift, it was clear and egregious, and the findings of the 12 jurors, the trial court, and the three Court of Appeals justices should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you.
I have 4 points for rebuttal. First, when counsel speaks about the clear and convincing standard by describing it as a hunt for a scintilla of evidence that leads to a firm conviction, it seems to me that that's a legal non sequitur. Because scintilla is a quantum requirement and clear and convincing is a quantum requirement, and I believe Mr. Justice Heck's most recent opinion has discussed this issue. So I don't think that is the standard.
I guess where I get confused is, doesn't the very word pretext almost imply some sort of malice? If
yes.
You're putting forth something as a pretextual matter and you're building a file as a pretext for what you're really doing, doesn't that just sort of subsume the concept of malice in and of itself?
It may well, Your Honor. The case has actually discussed this to some extent, and of course I think Your Honor understands that what we're looking for in the punitive damage context is a culpability that is greater than that which leads to ordinary liability. So to the extent that pretext implies a level of malice, what we are looking for then insofar as evidence to sustain the punitive damage award is something that's even greater than that. And we've probably not done any better than what was given here, and that is the actual malice, ill will, spite, and what have you. But it has to, you know, emanate from some sort of animus that is greater than that animus which...
How do you define that, though?
That's difficult.
If you've got a record of what the plaintiff claims in this case, of going back and fabricating a review... after the accident that had never been gone into before, of building a case that didn't exist by manipulating data. I mean, how do you separate pretext from super pretext from really bad pretext?
Well, I think it's very difficult, and I'm not sure that I can get much better than you sort of know it when you see it. Because there certainly is no legal standard by which that can be done. But certainly, I think if what were shown in this record is what Your Honor is suggesting, and that is a conscious building of a file to justify an end result, I would say that that probably is some evidence of actual malice. But that's just not what occurred in this case. I mean, the building of the record, I mean, this record of 10 accidents had already been compiled and was typewritten before this incident ever occurred. So I reject the notion that you can classify this entire investigation as entirely pretextual. They've never actually made the argument that this is pretextual in nature. But I think Your Honor raises a very, very good question. Is where is the dividing line as to the animus necessary for ordinary liability and that which is necessary for punitive damages? And you know, again, we use the Clemens versus Withers standard in this case, and it serves well, I think, but it has to be a particularly egregious and pointed type of animals, I think, and I'm not sure I can do much better than that. I hope that answers the question.
Well, for example, then saying someone will be disciplined before the investigation is done wouldn't get you there?
No, that would not get there at all, and particularly in this context, because that is precisely the point that we have tried to make. The statement that you're talking about is a document that was probably signed on November the 6th, and the decision to discipline this employee had been made 10 days earlier. So the statement that you're talking about is totally consistent with what our view of the factual scenario is, and I think in that particular context, rather than just kind of wrenching it out of context and putting it up, in context, it is a perfectly legitimate statement that I have made the decision based upon the threat to fellow employees and the public that this employee is going to be disciplined no matter what anybody says. And that's in context, that is precisely what that says.
Do you respond to the argument that whatever your points may be about a managerial review and not establishing the standard they set out for themselves in the charge, that was waived by that point not being brought to the court of appeal?
Your Honor, we have consistently in this case preserved and argued a no evidence point. In Justice Spector's decision in Rocky Mountain Helicopter, she espoused a rule that I had thought has been the rule all along, and that is that a no evidence review is simply a means of looking at what is and what is not evidence. And she said in that case that you can take any legal argument by which you can characterize evidence as non-probative under a blanket or generic no evidence standard. And so by simply citing the fact that we have no evidence of conduct by a managerial agent in this case, I'm simply saying, it seems to me, that there is no evidence of that type of conduct that is necessary to support the punitive damage award. So I guess what I'm really trying to say is that is the lens through which the court looks at the evidence to determine whether it is probative or non-probative. Agent definition, which was given to the jury. So it's not a question of preservation beyond simply saying there is no evidence. We can't do any better than that.
Any other questions?
Yes, briefly, what were your other 3 points?
the one that I just answered to the Chief Justice, but the other point was that what does the charge do wrong in this case? Counsel makes the argument, and I think it's probably factually correct, that, well, disqualification is a form of discrimination. The problem with using disqualification as a standard by which the jury could find liability is that it takes away the legal lens through which the court looks at the conduct, or which the jury, the finder of fact, looks at the conduct. You would not, for example, have a case in an ordinary automobile accident in which you said, did defendant fail to turn to the right, or was he otherwise negligent in operating his vehicle? The first of those simply takes away the reasonable man standard, and I think that's what was done in this case, and that's what the problem is. And I think that was important.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument in the first clause, and the court will now take a brief recess.
All right.